you know, we had, there's been some criticism of the way we've handled some of the poor victims. My wife and I, we have 17 grandkids, from 16 to 3. And we pray for them every night. We're going to start praying for those kids that got involved with some of the problems that we talked about. All right? They don't deserve it. They have nothing. We owe it to them to say a prayer for them and to make sure they know and understand that their life is still one that can be enriched, one that they can make a significant impact on other people and do a lot of different things, as all of you can. So God bless everybody.
We love you, Joe.
And in battle, Joe Paterno engulfed while leaving today for practice.
I know you guys have a lot of questions, and I was hoping...
His son denying reports that Penn State is already planning Paterno's exit.
Guys, no one has asked Joe to step down. That's all I can tell you at this time.
We love you, Joe!
As the coaching great of four decades gets in his car, cheers.
Joe Paterno! Joe Paterno!
Paterno caught up in a scandal involving his former defensive coordinator, Jerry Sandusky, alleged to have abused eight boys he met through the charity he started for at-risk youth.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is your host, Jim Clemente, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds. I am not former FBI, but I do cast them on TV, as well as serial killers and victims and everything in between. And I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes.
Well, Lisa and I are very excited today, and we wish Laura could be with us, but she's in the UK doing some amazing things on stalking and coercive control. So we are together, Lisa and I, with a very special guest.
I don't know how special I am, but this is Scott Paterno, and I'm happy to be here to talk with Jim and Lisa.
Could you expand upon who you are just a little more than that?
My name is Scott Paterno. My dad was Joe Paterno, and obviously there were some situations that brought Jim into play into my life, and fortunately or unfortunately, we've had a chance to get to know each other and talk about some of the issues that revolved around that case and try to get a better understanding of it.
Yeah. Well, we're very happy that you're joining us today because this case is back in the public zeitgeist again because of a movie called Paterno that's on HBO. And if our listeners haven't seen this movie yet, I think it's a good idea to watch it because it does raise a lot of great issues. And why we asked Scott to come on today was to figure out how much of that movie accurately portrayed what went on during that time and how much of it was sort of the fantasy of Hollywood.
Yeah, so, and even if you haven't seen the movie, you know, and you don't happen to get HBO, I mean, I think listening to the story you really will be interested. We're going to tick through all of the major events, you know, in the movie and have Scott opine on them. So I just want to say that this movie was directed by the great Barry Levinson, stars Al Pacino. They've worked together before on You Don't Know Jack, and Barry Levinson also directed the Bernie Madoff biopic that starred Robert De Niro. So go ahead, Jim. Sorry I interrupted you.
No, it's okay. So, yeah, I mean, I have to say, Scott, I didn't actually want to watch the movie because I had heard that they went off in fantasy land. And I didn't need to have that kind of, misdirection. But
I got to tell you, I had a tough time deciding when not to watch it too initially. And my point was, as I said to a friend of mine a couple of weeks ago, I said, look, even if they got it shot for shot accurate, you're talking about two of the worst weeks of my life. I found out my father had cancer, you know, all the other events that were taking place. So it wasn't like, you know, something you really wanted to go back, a portion of your life you wanted to relive. That being said, I think you're correct. It does raise a opportunity to discuss some of the more important issues that surrounded that case.
Right. Well, I have to say, I mean, the first question I want to ask you about, when you heard that Al Pacino would be portraying your father, what did you think about that?
You know, it's tough to say because my initial reaction was I really didn't want a movie to be made. I thought it would be better not to have one altogether. That being said, you know, Pacino's a hell of an actor, and I think there are certainly in portions of the movie he portrays my father in terms of his physical representation very accurately. I think obviously there's two things you got to look at when you see the movie. There's the performance of the actors, but there's also the script, and the script is going to drive what they say. So I don't look at it and say, Pacino's saying my dad said this. I look at it and say, the author says this is what he thinks dad was saying at that time, and Pacino's interpreting it. And when you see a guy like Al Pacino, it's impressive.
Did they ask for your blessing? Did they ask for your blessing or to be involved at all in this?
You know, not really. No, not for our blessing, certainly. What they did was they had purchased the rights to Joe Poznanski's book,
right,
which was
written
contemporaneously. There was some sort of timid, I wouldn't, timid's probably the wrong word, but there were some overtures initially. Our problem was if we participated in it and the product that came out was completely unacceptable, we had no creative control. So we would look like we were blessing a narrative that we didn't agree with. So we felt it was better to let it be produced completely outside of our influence and then comment on it after the fact.
Yeah, in all honesty, they really needed to have that objectivity too, because they don't want to produce, they don't want to make this and then have audiences feel like, you know, you were feeding them information, you know, that it has to be like an objective portrayal.
Dude, so I'm laughing because, you know, I'm laughing a little bit because if I had the ability to control the narrative at any point, we'd be having a completely different conversation today. Yeah, it was absolutely, I think, from their perspective, important that it was more focused on the accounts from Poznanski. And then obviously Sarah Gannon was an advisor on it. So her role, I think, was portrayed extremely favorably.
But can you go into a little bit about Poznanski's book? Was he embedded with your family during that? Or what was the nature of that book?
Well, you know, I think Joe would say it was probably Joe Poznanski would say it was an unfortunate confluence of events. His publisher might say it was fortunate. I don't know. But he was already writing a book on Dad when this happened. So he had already spent basically a year, year and a half being around Dad, being around some of us, interviewing some of my siblings and I, completely separate from all of this. So when this story breaks, as he's literally probably 6 weeks from wrapping up his book, obviously now it's got a new angle to it or a new piece to it. And yeah, he was around for a lot of it. Now, he was not in the room the 2 weeks that they're talking about. Ironically, his employer would not let him be there. So he was not in the room during those. And I think they were worried about his objectivity. If he's sitting in the kitchen table, how is he going to write a story that's objective about, you know, what's going on?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Okay.
Well, so Scott, when you started watching the movie, what were your initial reactions as the movie opened?
Well, yeah, it's interesting because the opening, of course, is set on Dad's last game, which is, you know, bookended in the front end of that 2 week period, and it starts off with a segment from John Eubanks' book where my brother just loses it on a guy on the sideline who grabs a headset. That's all fiction. I mean, like, now it's in John Eubanks' book, but the guy that's allegedly on the headset has already said that didn't happen. Jay said it didn't happen. It was Hollywood. So you know, they got to open it hot. They've got to come in and try to do almost like that. I call it that old West Wing opening, you know, where they would have 4 or 5 minutes of lead up and then boom, here we are. You're in the store.
Right. So yeah, the first 12 minutes that I counted of this movie is all about, for people who maybe don't know the whole Penn State culture and know the story, just to get them into that game day and all of the drama going on the field, up in the booth, you know, behind the scenes, in the bars, and sort of, you know, dropping us into that, you know, and the tensions. I mean, that event probably maybe didn't happen, but I'm sure there were, you know, tensions and all kinds of drama going on as your dad is trying to direct the players from a booth, you know, and not be on this, you know, all that is true, isn't it?
Oh, sure, sure. When it happened earlier that year, he got hit on the sidelines. The guy was running a route. He was looking the other way and they collided and he had 3 cracked ribs and a fracture in his shin, I think it was. So he was not, yeah. So he was definitely in the booth. Now, what was, you know, where the Hollywood part of it comes into it, and it just, there was not that much drama between the coaches and the players because it was actually fairly routine. There was a lot of times in the previous years when he had fractured his knee probably 5 years prior to that. He had to do a year in the booth. So, you know, they had that routine down. Now, yes, Hollywood is trying to get you into the look at the excitement, look at the crowd, look at how big this is and how big the you know, the culture, I guess is the wrong term for me, the institution, Penn State and everything else. I think it does it's a good job of dropping you in. I just, you know, some of it, my problem with, and the reason why I bring up the part with Jay, Lisa, is because it does set a stage that Jay shouldn't be taken as seriously in terms of his role in the story, because he's just a football coach. And that's really not how it played out.
Oh, okay. When I see that, those scenes, I see that he's just really under pressure to live up to his father's legacy. And I mean, I don't know if that's true or not. I don't know anything about football. I don't know anything about Penn State or nothing. But I would imagine that if you're the son of this legendary football coach, damn, that must be hard, you know?
Well, sure. And I think that that's, you know, one of the reasons that Jay's career was so much more difficult for him than I think any other coach with his skill level and where he had been, was in part because there was that expectation, you're going to be Joe, and nobody's going to be Joe. And it's, you can't be, it's the same thing people tell me now. I'll get, somebody will comment about the new coach, say, well, he does this differently than your father. And my response is always, of course he does. Anybody in that type of a role is going to want to make it their own. And I think, you know, Jay's portrayal was relevant to, you know, to us, because as it plays out, there's a scene where they're standing on the sideline of practice where he's like, just keep it about football. And it's, you know, that didn't happen. And none of us were foolish enough to think that it was ever going to be just about football that week.
Mm-hmm. Well, just for our listeners, so this game that they were depicting at the beginning was potentially the 409th win under Joe Paterno's head coaching career, right? And correct. So that's a huge number, because it would put him as the winningest coach in college football history. Is that right?
Well, you have to say major college football history, because there's a guy at Mount Union who's won about 800 games, I think. No, it's like 500, I think, John Gigliardi. But dad was going to pass Eddie Robinson from Grambling. So he'd already had the Division I record. The Division I AA record was Eddie Robinson at 408. And so that game is, so we're in a season where we're 7-1 when that game opens up. We are pretty underrated, mainly because we were winning games close and ugly, just like the game that you see depicted. But people forget, you know, when that whole thing breaks, we're 8-1 at that time. We're not an 8-4, 8-5 team. It was actually a fairly tense game, because if we win that game, we've got the inside track to get to the Big Ten championship game. So, I think that they build that tension, and they build – sort of the momentous occasion, and again, from, you know, if you're a scriptwriter, what better drama than here he is, he sets the all-time record, and a week later we're talking about a whole different discussion.
Yeah. Right. So how many fans are actually in that stadium?
Oh God, that game probably 108,000, 109,000.
Okay, and then how many people are watching it on TV?
Well, I couldn't speak to that game in particular, but, you know, a couple million more usually. And it's depending on whether it was a Big Ten Network game or whether it was. But, yeah, you're talking about a huge audience for the game. And if certainly it would, you know, SportsCenter carried the highlights and the speeches and all the, you know, the plaque presentation afterwards. So it was a big deal.
Yeah. All right. Well, that, I think that does set the stage pretty well for how big a deal what would come will really be. But I think the first thing that I'd like to ask you about is, at some point during this game, they depict a conversation in the hallway with Spanier, Schultz, and Curley. And that would be the president of the university, Spanier, the vice president of the university, Schultz, and the athletic director, Curley. Is that right?
Correct. Well, yeah, they depict it, sure. Yeah.
And is this is the part where the reporter comes up to them?
Yes.
In the tunnel. Okay, so I just want to shout out, because Kaliswa Brewster plays that reporter, and she was my student. So go, Kaliswa, for getting a great role. Okay, continue. Sorry. that's my only role here, Scott, as you know, is to comment upon the movie. Okay, go ahead, Jim.
In that meeting that they depict, that's based on what, Scott? In your experience?
Well, you know, and that one's where they're discussing the actual indictments coming down. I'm not actually sure they knew that was going to happen till the next day. So I'm fairly certain that conversation, and it would have been emails. And a lot of those conversations, they use that device a couple of times in the flashback scenes in the movie, where you have these three guys sort of huddled around having these sort of clandestine conversations. That didn't happen. Those were emails. These were not guys trying to, you know, secretly have a conversation. These were people struggling with a situation they didn't know how to handle.
Well, how do you know they never had conversations?
Well, it's not that. It's the other way around. He knows that they had emails back and forth. And
yeah, the email
no
traffic is something
there's
that was introduced both
never
by
been
the
an allegation
at some point.
That they, yeah,
right,
there's
but
never
you
been
don't know that they didn't have.
There's never been an allegation. There's never been an allegation that they ever met about this. There was emails back and forth because they were traveling at the time, some because they're in different offices and different places in the university. And what the only fact is that there are emails that go back and forth between Curley, Schultz, and Spanier.
And Lisa, just to get to your point where you're saying, you know, yeah, how do you know they didn't have a conversation? I can't tell you unequivocally they never spoke to each other. What I can tell you is that the director, I think, in an interview, I don't know where I read it, acknowledged that those conversations were depictions of the email traffic. And so what they were, you know, obviously you can't make a movie where you just show emails going back and forth. It loses creative. I mean, they're not going to do a You've Got Mail version of this, mm-hmm. where you see these guys typing and reading to each other. And it certainly advances the idea that there was a conspiracy. But yeah, Gary Schultz, if you want to talk about the guy who really got a raw depiction in this, is Gary Schultz. Because the whole thing with the secretary in the file, that never happened like that. They turned over the file to the AG's office themselves. It's just, but it was a good creative license.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I just wonder why they had that. I mean, that's weird. If there's no truth to that little nugget, I'm just wondering where that came from.
Well, we'll just tell you, it never happened. There's no one has ever said ever in a trial, in a newspaper article, in any way, shape, or form that happened. You know why it happened, because this is a fictional movie based on reality.
No, I know that, Jim, but people pick and choose different things to put in different places for different reasons, you know, particular things in different place, particular reason. And so what does that accomplish? I mean, I don't think you can just say, it's just Hollywood. I mean, I think these are very, very savvy and careful filmmakers. And
yeah, but they weren't making a documentary. They weren't making a documentary
at all.
So why do you have to be careful when you're just basing it on the truth? How many hundreds of thousands of hours of film is completely faked? And that's why, I mean, just it's for creative reasons. That's why they say based on a true story and not a true story, because it's only a true story if everything it depicts.
No, I understand that. So, but I'm just, what do they get out of having the secretary call him and say,
we're way ahead of that. Like,
I thought we were talking about
there.
That. I thought we were talking about that.
He referenced it.
I brought it up.
Okay. All right. Okay. Let's back
up
then.
I did bring it up.
No, that's okay.
But go ahead, Jim.
So, and because when we get there, Scott and I will tell you exactly what did happen.
Okay,
because
cool.
That there is a fact, there is a record of that. There is plenty of testimony about that. And so there's no question what really happened.
Okay.
But it's one of the areas in which somebody decided to, you know, go creative instead of go
right. But those are the things I get nitpicky about. And I'm not challenging you, Jim or Scott. I'm just saying that in such an explosive story like this, they could have put anything, you know, anything anywhere. So I'm always very curious as to why that little part.
That's what the indictment's only about 23 pages, and it breaks it down into each individual case, each victim, each of these 8 victims. And it starts off, I should say, the indictment, the jurors started by saying, they all but come out and say that this charity was a point for him to get access to kids. It says basically many of these boys were vulnerable due to their social situations, and this was how he found his victims.
So the next tentpole in this movie was basically that the indictment of Jerry Sandusky sort of got posted and then disappeared.
Correct.
Can you tell us what really happened around that?
Well, as far as I can tell, it was put up by somebody to make sure that it got out and leaked that Friday and then into the press that Friday and then taken back down because somebody complained. And it was put up, I think it was up for like an hour, hour and a half. Now, that being said, Jim, I mean, you know, that's one of those, of course they did that. Because of course they wanted to get the indictment out there, and that's of all the things that happened in that sort of setup, that one probably bothers me the least. Maybe I'm unique that way, but I think the presentment itself was a bigger problem. I mean, the actual language using that. And, yeah, and that's something that is a quick aside, Jim. You and I both have talked about this before. Presentments as the as a document themselves are problematic if you want to have a jury that can think clearly.
Right. So a couple things. Who are they that you're referring to? And when you say presentment, can you explain to our listeners what you mean by that?
Well, the Attorney General's office is who I posted the presentment on the website the Friday that they show her looking at it at the Patriot News. And the presentment itself was a 23-page document that goes through the allegations that have been the indictment that's been served on Jerry with very specific language in it that is incendiary, and it's designed to be incendiary. It's a charging document. And it's throughout history, throughout our, you know, our judicial history, we found them to be so incendiary that the federal government won't allow them anymore. It's only a handful of states that still make use of them, Pennsylvania being one of them. Mm-hmm. And it was written in a way to create a very specific narrative. True or untrue is irrelevant. The way it was released was designed to create a firestorm around it. I understand from the AG's office, and I've had someone in the AG's office make this case to me, they were trying to create a story so that they would get other victims to come forward. And I'm not going to fault them for that. But it was handled in the way that was guaranteed to create a media firestorm.
Right. And the problem with using it in that particular way, and I think this might be, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, why this upset you. But the fact is that if they did use it to get other victims to come forward, they put in it so much detailed information that it could actually not only taint the jury pool, which is bad enough, but taint potential other victims out there or induce other people to come forward with false allegations, right? I mean, isn't that a problem?
Well, it certainly it gives that opportunity, and that's part of the reason why, and I'm going to use the Zodiac Killer case. They didn't release certain details to prevent getting all these false leads. And in this case, they put incredible detail and in some cases inaccurate detail as according to the witnesses that they were quoting.
Right.
In order to create this, you know, create the mood that they did. Now, that all being said, Jim, and I this is a fine line we dance. And you and I have talked about this before. I don't want to be perceived as saying people, you know, everybody that came forward wasn't telling the truth, because that's obviously not the case. I think the concern is you create
impression.
Yeah, and you give the ability for that to take place. Right. And unfortunately, stuff gets lost in the wash that way, because then people, you know, there's a logical fallacy where people will disprove one, you know, victim and then say all of them are lying.
Yeah.
And the same thing is true if one's telling the truth, they're not all telling the truth. So it's a logical fallacy. And the presentment created that problem.
Right. And so the reason why I raised it was because it gave people on the outside the ability to argue that, oh, well, that, of course, all these people are coming out of the woodwork. They read all this stuff. And so they matched their story to this. And unfortunately, it undermines credible, actual victims because they did it this way. So unfortunate.
Can I ask you, so is this the part where the statement like is online like for a brief second and then it's disappeared?
Yes.
Is that true? Did that happen?
Yeah, it was gone for about an hour and a half, yeah.
Why did they pull it off?
Because it wasn't supposed to be released yet. They were supposed to wait until they did the actual charging on Monday. So it's just from a actual impact on the case, it's really not that relevant. But from the standpoint of showing how the case was being handled from a lot of levels, it is relevant that it was put up that way.
And it does kind of, because what it kind of portrays in the movie is like somebody yanked it. Like it makes sort of like a conspiracy wonks, you know, wet dream, because, you know, it's flashes just for a second and then it's yanked and you get the sense that somebody pulled it, somebody with strings, you know, pulled that off the internet. You know, it just sets up this tone of conspiracy and collusion. Don't you think, Jim? I mean,
why wasn't it supposed to be released till Monday?
Well, because that's when they were having they were going to formally charge Jerry and the other two gentlemen. They were going to announce the charges that Monday at that press conference they had. And that's usually when they release the presentment. Now, and Lisa, this is, you want to talk about conspiracy theory nuts. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I am a believer in PR and how people manipulate, I shouldn't say manipulate, it's the wrong term, but how people use windows to create what they want. And what gets lost in that movie is we had an open date that weekend. So Penn State's off that Saturday. So we have the game where Dad wins the breaks the record the Saturday, October 29th. The presentment comes out on a Friday on a weekend when there is no other Penn State football news in the state of Pennsylvania. And I will tell you, I think initially some of the people involved in this case from the AG's office and some of the people involved from Penn State's side of it, Cynthia Baldwin in particular, did not realize how big of a story this was actually going to be. Mm-hmm. And so I think they were trying to capture the Penn State media market and did not realize they had just, you know, lit off of a grenade a couple of days early.
Right. So just also one more point of clarification. So why you say the AG's office, that's the attorney general's office. Why is the attorney general the prosecuting office in this particular case?
Well, there was a couple of reasons. I mean, first, I think that the Mifflin County DA or Clinton County, I forget which one it started in, had a conflict because of the work with the school. And then the Center County DA, where they think that a lot of the conduct took place, is actually married to one of Jerry's adopted kids' sisters, biological sisters. So he had a conflict. And I think the real reason is they knew this was going to get big and quick, and they dumped it out very fast. And once it got down to the AG's office, you had a guy that was running for governor then at the time when it shows up on his desk, and it became a very big case very fast.
And why is it a big case? Because of the size of the sort of the aura around the Penn State football team, because of how popular Jerry Sandusky was. What are the reasons?
Well, I think it's a combination of all of that. But I think the big thing is, and let's start off with it, it's a big case because Jerry's an offender, and he's somebody that was offending. So that's, it starts off with the root of you have a problem with Jerry and his conduct. But it becomes a bigger case from a media perspective. It becomes a national case because of the profile of my father, because of the profile of Penn State, because of the profile of Jerry, and in particular because Penn State had a reputation of doing things the right way. And frankly, this is the part that's kind of frustrating for people that are Penn Staters that had no connection to this case. Penn State did do things the right way. Every one of those players that graduated. 86% of the players graduated. None of that was faked by any of this stuff. And for it to be a cast and aspersion on the overall program seemed to make no sense. But what it definitely, the overall reputation of the program made the quote unquote fall from grace. I think that's the HBO tagline, what the bigger the legend, the higher the fall, made that a much bigger story because you had this iconic program that was known for doing it the right way.
In the presentment, when it did come out, and we can name the name of the victim because he has actually come forward and written a book about his experiences and so forth. The issue that they raise and they sort of follow it as a trail throughout this movie is that Aaron had come forward not in 2011, but in 2009. And correct. The circumstances around that, I'll just really quickly go through them. He reported to his mother, who then brought him into the school superintendent, and they reported that Jerry Sandusky had sexually victimized him. And the school official reportedly said, "You should go home and sleep on it because this is a very, very good man and you're destroying his reputation," something to that effect.
Yeah, that's the initial report that's made in 2009.
And that's to his school. That's not to Penn State. When you say school, it's not
right.
To...
Yeah. Oh, Jerry's been retired at that time for 10 years. He hasn't been a Penn State employee for 10 years when this conduct's reported. And this is at a high school 45 minutes an hour from State College. Mm-hmm. And yes, he reports, and the principal, the same guy, I believe, Jim, is the same guy that one day sees Jerry wrestling the kid in the dark in the wrestling room and doesn't think anything of it. So, and this gets back to what I think where HBO kind of missed the boat. The one thing that I don't think that anybody can really understand until you've known somebody who's had this type of, I knew Jerry my entire life, from the time I was born. And until you have somebody you've been around like that in that type of a context your whole life and have to now completely reassess them, it's impossible to really understand how hard it is to be able to get your head around what you're being told.
It's exactly what I would like to bring out from you. You did have experience with Jerry your entire life. And from the outside, people look and they say, they point and they say, wait a minute, this guy, Jerry Sandusky, he's always around kids. He's always around boys. And he adopted five boys for himself and one girl for his wife. He fostered all these kids. He started Second Mile. He was always around these kids. He was always doing special things. He was taking them out of class. He was teaching them. He was doing wrestling moves. He was working out with them. He was showering with them. How could you not see this? But what they don't realize is the flip side of that. It's everything, all your experiences with him over the course of decades. And this is both at the school and in church and in the community and in fundraising and in events. And he's around kids all this time, right? And what were the kids' reaction to him? What were there any indications from the children themselves that there was something bad going on?
I mean, and obviously not anything that I saw or, you know, was communicated to us. And that's kind of the problem that was always underlying trying to get your head around it is how did these, you know, how did we not hear this? And I think you talked about this, you know, in 2012. You know, it's tough for a boy to come forward when this type of abuse takes place. And so obviously we didn't see something that wasn't obvious to us. And if it wasn't being, you know, told to us, you just didn't think to see it. I always use the analogy, and I'm expressing this badly, but I always compare it to The Sixth Sense. Once you know Bruce Willis is, and I'm spoilers for anybody who hasn't seen The Sixth Sense, but you know, once you know he's a ghost, it's you see, oh my God, her breath is, you know, she never actually makes eye contact with him, you know, the whole nine yards. And the same thing with when you finally come to grips with what you are being told and what you're seeing and what, and you replay all those interactions throughout the, you know, your previous life, yeah, you see it in a different light. And obviously at the time you saw it as, hey, this is a great guy. Here's a guy who is spending time and mentoring kids that nobody wants to spend time with, that their parents are basically completely absent, or if they are in their lives, they're a negative influence. And here comes this white knight riding in to provide this stability in their lives. And it, you know, there's a scene where Pacino says, you know, the president of the United States, you know, Jerry was one of the thousand points of light under Bush 41.
Right.
And it was, you know, and that's because on the outside, he had created this perfect facade that this is a guy who cares more about kids than their own parents do. And that was one of the things you said to me first, Jim, that I tell every one of my friends' parents, if somebody wants to spend more time with your kids than you do, that's a problem.
But yeah. Jim, also, isn't this a strategy for these kind of offenders where, you know, he's not going to mess around with Paterno's kids. He's going to spend a lot of time with them and be, you know, the perfect Uncle Jerry or whatever to, you know, Scott and his brothers and sisters. Because that's his cover, because everybody will say, oh yeah, well, he didn't, you know, mess around with my children. Therefore he couldn't possibly be doing anything wrong with these other kids who don't have, you know, parents to protect them.
Right. I'm trying to use the hand to bump in on you, Lisa. One thing, just to be clear, Jerry was never like an Uncle Jerry to us.
Oh, sorry. Well, okay.
The reason why I raised that is because Jerry's actually, that was one of the things that was tough for us to understand, because Jerry did not actually spend a whole lot of time, like other coaches you would see hanging out at, you know, at various social functions on a bowl trip or whatever. Jerry was always off doing something with the kids he brought with him. And he always had either his adopted kids or, you know, foster kids or Second Mile kids. Like, he just, if he had free time, he was spending it with that organization. And by all indications, it looked like it was a good thing.
Yeah. And you are right though, Lisa, that the grooming process doesn't just get directed at the children that he's trying to get access to for sex. It's directed at the parents, the guardians, the organization, the community, the world in Jerry's case, because, I mean, he's a personality on TV. He's part of a team that is being, you know, broadcast nationally. And so he's got this aura around him of, you know, the sort of nice guy, aw shucks, wonderful person who wants to help kids. And unfortunately, the people who are closest to him are the ones that see all those day-to-day interactions of him, quote, doing good. And he is actually doing good. Let's get that out there. People who do good can also be sexually attracted to kids and do bad. And so we have to not, as a community, as a people, as parents, as people in the community, we have to not think that just because someone does good things or is a pal, a buddy of ours, or a good friend, or does nice things. Just because of that, it doesn't mean that they're not also sexually attracted to kids. You have to scrutinize them just as much, if not more, than the people who aren't doing good things. Because stranger danger, although it is real, is a very minute portion of the number of offenses that are committed against children. It is a very extremely rare circumstance, at least in the United States of America. But the kind of offender that Jerry is incredibly common. And as I said, when I wrote the report in 2012, right, Scott, there are thousands of them like him right now. And I, you know, begged for people to listen and look and scrutinize people in their lives that have access to kids who they trust and know and love, because those are the people who are most likely going to take advantage of that trust and victimize their kids.
Well, and that, you know, that's like the Nassar situation, Jim. I mean, if you look at how those kids, and you're hearing in these reports, even just yesterday, that, you know, that 180 of the 250 girls that have come forward were victimized while their mother was in the mother or father was in the room.
Right.
And it's, that was the thing you told me, like that casual contact or that authoritative contact in front of a parent reinforces that this is okay. And it just, those things, you know, those behaviors and how Jerry was part of all these different organizations helping kids certainly gave him this veneer of being a guy that really cares about kids.
Right. And legitimately, he does actually, I'm sure, really care about kids. But it goes a step further with him, and a very criminal step further, in that he expresses that caring to certain kids in a sexual way. And that is absolutely forbidden, absolutely wrong. And there's nothing good about that. Although in his mind, I'm sure he rationalized that and projected the blame on the kids themselves and minimized what he did. So those are typical things that offenders do, and it doesn't make what they did any better. It's actually just part of their MO.
And just for the victims who I know are listening out there, of not just Sandusky's victims, but all kinds of victims, they're, what do you say, Jim, that he makes it seem like it is consensual, and it is not consensual. It can never be consensual.
Right, because there's an imbalance of power, and there's also manipulation going on. And, you know, grooming is a process that offenders develop over the course of their careers, and they typically get better and better and better at it as the years and the decades go on. And they're able to pick up on vulnerabilities of their intended victims and vulnerabilities of those people that are responsible for those victims, and vulnerabilities in the community. And they exploit those vulnerabilities, like Jerry did so well, by starting the second mile, by making sure that all the clout he had on the football team was went into, you know, getting people to donate and getting people to you know, to basically give him adulation and making his job easier as a groomer and offender. So he was, I said in the report, I think that he was in the top 1% of groomers, because I think his methodology was so sophisticated, and his you know, ability to, you know, pull the wool over the eyes of the community and parents and guardians was just unprecedented. However, I will say that Nassar had him beat, because Nassar actually used the profession, his medical degree, he used it as an excuse. He claimed that what he was doing to his victims was actually a legitimate medical treatment. And for Christ's sakes, you know, he's talking to non-medical people, and he's talking to medical people, and he's able to convince them that what he's doing is actually necessary. And that, we know now, was 100% bullshit. But because of his position, because of his authority, because of those, you know, two letters, MD, everybody kind of bent over backwards around him. And I don't know, because I haven't done an investigation into the details of that case, I don't know whether there was deliberate or just, you know, or pathetic or
I think you should, because I think those fucking coaches knew. I'm sorry. Excuse me, Scott. I know that we're, I mean, I think there were many.
Listen, the one thing the movie got correct was I actually used that word. So you're not going to offend me.
Yeah. So wait, when you're saying the coaches in the Michigan State University?
Yes, I do. Because I think there were many, many reports from parents to those coaches. And I would really love for you to.
But what I was talking about, though, is the way that Nassar survived those things, those allegations, was that he literally went toe to toe with these people, head to head, saying, wait, what you think is bad is actually good, legitimate medical practice. You can't fault me for that. I'm doing what I need to do to make these incredible athletes more incredible, to let them do their job so they can win these medals. And their athletes were. And so people, you know, even if they found it hard to believe, or even if they found it, unbelievable, they saw the results.
Yeah.
Also, I'm not justifying that. I'm just saying how he used the system to get away with it for longer. But also, you know, there were restrictions put on him by the medical professionals who did sort of have to deal with these allegations. And those restrictions were not followed. So that is a definitive actual breach of their fiduciary duty to those victims. To those patients.
And the guy that actually failed to enforce those protocols was charged himself.
Yes.
And not in relation to that, in relation to his own conduct.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't realize that. Tell me more.
Oh, he was charged with sexually harassing interns or sexual assault on an intern. I don't know the exact specifics. It was like three charges. There was one charge of relating to Nassar and three charges of his own. This is about 2-3 weeks ago.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe that's something we need to get into, Jim. But
yeah, we definitely will.
Because this is such a big deal for people in Pennsylvania, for the fans of Penn State, for fans of Joe Paterno, to know what it is exactly that he knew. It's been such a back and forth having these gray areas. People want to know, and hopefully this will start to give them some answers.
Okay, so I want to go back and talk about the depiction of your family, which may be completely not at all accurate, but they were some of my favorite scenes in the movie, of your brothers and sisters and your father all trying to, you know, wrestle with this indictment. And your father, you know, he just wants to watch football. He just wants to prepare for his game. And you're, I don't know, I just love, and I love Greg Grunberg, who plays you. I don't know how you felt about his depiction, but we know Greg well. He recurred on Criminal Minds as Jennifer Love Hewitt's husband. And Annie Parisi, I knew in New York, we trained together. So I just love that family unit. What did you think about it?
Well, you know, it's obviously a little different when you're looking at yourself being portrayed, and some of the stuff that was inaccurate gets to you. But no, I think some of the stuff that they captured, the sitting around the table, talking it through, and my father, you know, he was initially very focused on, hey, look, I did what I was supposed to do in this case. There's nothing more I can do. There's a legal process. I'm going to get ready for the part that I can control, and that's the game next week. And that, you know, that was, it was tough to see that re-portrayed, but some of it was accurate. Some of it, you know, my brother and I, while we fight often, nobody was really fighting with each other at that time. There was a lot of, you know, hey, you need to handle this. I need to handle this. And Jay was coaching, so he wasn't even there a lot of the time. So some of those depictions were, yeah, a little hokey. And certainly the one that cracked me up the most, Lisa, was the Googling Dan McGinn, when in reality I had reached out to George Bush 41's chief of staff and a number of other people in D.C. to give me some recommendations on people in that situation. So, I mean, it obviously makes for a better story for it to be like we're Googling this.
Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, and that's kind of where it gets into the parts that got – yeah. While it's fun to move – fun's probably the wrong term for me personally, but in terms of filmmaking, it helps move the dialogue along, moves the dynamic along. But then there were the scenes like where my mom's reading the report and she gets sick, and that's true. And
yeah.
That was tough to see again. Because,
how did they know that? Did they just imagine that it would make her sick, or is there a statement from her somewhere, or, you know, I would imagine it would make her sick.
I think it was in Happy Valley, the documentary. But I mean, she definitely has said that before, but it was, and that was really what was strange was, you know, trying to, my parents were very, you know, old school, like, you know, just, it's, they didn't, yeah. we didn't talk about this type of stuff. So when I had to get across to my parents, you need to know what they're saying and you need to know what's in this, and trying to explain to my mother some of this stuff and my father some of this stuff, it was, you know, it was very, very difficult to see those moments again. Yeah. Because it was peeling back a level of innocence from my mother, who, you know, my mom loves kids. And the idea that somebody could hurt a kid to her is so foreign. I mean, right now, while we're doing this, she's doing a fundraising 5K that she's, you know, raised all the money for to help Special Olympics. And she's going to raise $500,000 today. Wow. And that's because that's what she, you know, she just, so when you had to say to her, there's a guy that was using not only Penn State, but your husband's name and your family name and the hard work that you put into it to then turn around and use that as a way to victimize children. It just, it was so hard for her to grasp, and it was hard for my father to grasp. I mean, one of the scenes where he says, you know, we're talking about what is sodomy. It was, you know, when I explained it to him, he said, can a man actually do that to a boy?
So yeah. Let's back that up, because that's a really important point, Scott. So you, in this movie, and I know in the real world, had to convince your father, Joe Paterno, to actually read the presentment. I mean, the presentment was a very long, very detailed, very graphic document. And in your, you, I know you've explained to me, but please explain to our audience, your father didn't actually talk about sexual terms. He didn't like people to use them around him. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it's just, it goes back to, this is a guy who was born in 1926 and went to a Jesuit, you know, high school, and, you know, was in the service and then gets married. You know, just did not have, had a very straightforward Catholic, you don't talk about certain things certain ways ever. And what was really funny is in going through, so we had to go through a whole bunch of stuff for discovery. So I'm going through, the man had notes on top of notes with notes, not about this, but about everything. And I find this staff, I have this squad meeting note where he's given a talk to his players when they're coming back, and some of the new kids, you know, the freshmen, they're coming in, and he's trying to get across to them that because you're now a football player, there may be girls out there that want to do things with you because you're now a football player. And he couldn't figure out how to say it. So he said, there may be girls that want to lay around with you and you need to be wary of that. And I'm reading it, I'm going like, and I'm sitting there thinking, there's probably kids that walked out. They go, what was Joe talking about? Lay around? Like, is he talking about like sleepovers? What is he talking about? But he just didn't have, he was never comfortable with that type of, now he wasn't, you know, the guy had five kids. So clearly he understood how the thing worked. But it was just not something he was ever comfortable talking about. And Jim, I think I told you this story. My, you know, birds and the bees talk was, don't let your mother find out.
Yeah.
I mean, well, literally, that was what he said. You know, I'm not going to tell you not to, because you obviously already are, but, you know, understand their consequences. But above all else, do not let your mother find out, because I don't want to talk to her about it.
Right. So one of the things I think you also told me about was the fact that he didn't allow any kind of trash talk or sex talk in the locker room by the football players, which, you know, traditionally football locker rooms are very boisterous and very
crude.
How can we say?
Crude and yes.
Yeah, that's, I mean, and that's true. Now, I would tell you that having been in that locker room and Joe wasn't in there, it was a regular locker room in the sense that guys talked like guys when he wasn't around. But yeah, there was a certain deference around Joe. I think this is what plays into the whole McQueary not giving him the
right
the detail that he later found. You know, it was a question of you just didn't talk to Joe that way. I mean, you remember the time this takes place, he was 80. When the story, you know, he's in his 80s when the story breaks. He was in his 70s when he's told about this in 2001. You know, so this is not a young guy at the time that, and he was more of a grandfather at that point, especially to a guy like McQueary. So you just didn't talk about things graphically with him.
So it took you a long time to actually convince Joe to read the presentment.
And they represent that. That's what they represent in the movie. So that's at least part of that's accurate.
So it took you a long time to actually get Joe to read the presentment. And when he was reading it, did he ask you a lot of questions? Did he just have that one? Like, what is sodomy? What do they mean by that?
Well, one of the things where the story's obviously trying to, you know, the movie's trying to keep it moving along. I wasn't physically in the house with him when he finally read it. So this was Sunday after it comes out on
Monday. I mean, it's Monday after it came out on a Friday. And I had said to him over the weekend, you need to read it. I don't want to, and you know, his comment was, I don't want to read that. You've told me what's in it. Some of that stuff is accurate. I think that's in Poznanski's book. And that's it, when we finally get him to read it, he called me afterwards. And his first question was, you know, when they say sodomy, what are they talking about? And because to him, it's, you know, I think he's thinking of it in biblical terms. And that, you know, I don't think he even understood it when he read it in the Bible. But when the other questions were, you know, do you know the people involved in this in terms of the AG's office? Is this, you know, he was just trying to get a feeling for, you know, is this really, is this, am I being sold a bill of goods or is this really what happened? And I said, you know, so our conversations were more along the lines of, look, they've got too many people talking about Jerry in connection with what you've confirmed to me, which is Jerry was in a shower with a kid in 2001. You were, you know, that's the one thing, Jim, I keep coming back to people that want to, you know, pick and poke and everything else. I'm like, but at the end of the day, in 1998, he's told not to shower with kids. And in 2001, he's showering with a kid late at night on a day when there's unlikely to be anybody else in the building. And it's, you know, that is, you know, I was trying to get across the dad, you know, that's enough for this discussion. You know, the rest of it, there's a court of law, they'll go through a trial and everything else. But from your perspective, you know, when you're reading this, you have to put in the context that you know some of this is true because it was told to you in the context. And when I say what it was told him was Jerry's in the shower. I didn't see anything. You know, years later it became Jerry in the shower and he's anally raping the child, which Mike himself testified he never said to Joe at that time or at any time. But, you know, what he knew was Jerry did in fact take that kid into a shower and Mike was uncomfortable by it. And that was enough to start the process of looking at whether or not there was something worse there. And of course, as you know, it led to everything else.
Right. So we'll get to those details as we move forward. But the fact is this presentment laid it out in a way that very definitively said that Mike McQuarrie alleges in this presentment that he witnessed Jerry Sandusky anally raping a 10 to 12 year old boy in the shower. And that information shocked Joe. Am I right?
Oh, correct. Yes. And it shocked Mike, to be honest with you, because there's an email from Mike that came out in one of the lawsuits to the AG's office saying, you guys misrepresented what I said. And, you know, where he, you know, gets close to saying, I believe that the kid was being annually raped. He says he never saw it. And in fact, contemporaneous to talking to my dad, he talks to his father and a family friend and says, I didn't see anything sexual, but I heard rhythmic slapping sounds and Jerry was in the shower with a kid.
Right.
Now, all those things, you know, you can get to the conclusion. Now, interestingly enough, Jim, the jury actually did not convict Jerry on the deviant sexual intercourse charge as it related to Mike. So they didn't, you know, they didn't get to the same point that some of the other reports did. But certainly Mike comes into the shower, sees that, and you know, now you've got.
Right. You know, so when you say that, you know, what you, let me just spell it out a little more clearly. What you're saying is at trial, Jerry Sandusky was acquitted of the charge of anally raping that child that Mike McQuarrie allegedly had witnessed. The jury did not feel that there was enough to prove that that actually happened. So that kind of goes sort of hand in hand with how Mike McQuarrie's story had changed over the years. Is it right?
Yeah. Mike's story evolved, I think is the best way to put it. And again, this is, you know, in part because here's a kid who, and I feel bad for Mike in this respect, his life was going to get atom bombed by this, no matter if he had acted perfectly in every situation. But when the story comes out that it's now says in the presentment, he saw an anal rape, he immediately gets crucified for not having done more in that exact moment. You know, this is a guy who's, you know, 28 years old. He's 6'4". He's a former NFL quarterback. He's a big physical guy. And if you saw somebody being raped, why wouldn't you have stepped in and grabbed the 60-something-year-old guy and thrown him off the boy? And so Mike's story changes subtly and then more dramatically as time wears on because he's, I think in part because the more, and you know this, Jim, when you've dealt with witnesses, the more they tell the story, the more they suddenly, you know, start adding pieces to it that, you know, so when he first goes to Joe and he first goes to his dad and goes to Doc Duranoff, who's a mandatory reporter, by the way, and tells this story, the story does not include a definitive, I saw sex taking place.
And that was the problem. And the reason why, you know, by the way, that I think the jury didn't convict on that is that the state never produced the victim in that particular
incident.
Well, that's
what I was just about to ask. What happened to that victim? I mean,
well, they've never identified him. And there is somebody who came forward who said that he was in the shower with Jerry around that time and that anal rape did not take place. But, you know, was that a kid minimizing what happened to him? Was that a kid trying to not get Jerry in trouble? I'm sorry.
The kid that came forward, and I'm not going to use his name because he hasn't used it publicly, but his original statement was, I was in the shower, nothing happened. And then in the course of other proceedings, and he testified actually at Jerry's, there was a hearing about whether or not Jerry would get a new trial about a month and a half, 2 months, maybe it's 3 months ago now. And the kid that is identified as victim two now, testified that he was being groomed he's now gone the other way on that.
Right. Right. But, and I was going to get there, but what he did was he said that he did not, he was not anally raped during that time period. Okay. And now, if I'm not mistaken, what he has said is, yes, he was being groomed and there is some truth to what McQuarrie saw, but it wasn't anal rape.
So maybe Sandusky was masturbating against him or whatever. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I don't know. When you say masturbating against him, that sounds like a very complicated thing. In other words, if you know what his MO is, in the showers, what he would do is soap up kids and have soap fights and slapping fights with towels and you know, have kids slide across the floor and grab them and things like that, bear hug kids, things like that. So it could have been any number of those things. If his genitals had contact with the body of the victim at any time, that could constitute a sexual assault legally. But the child may not experience it as that. The child may not be aware of that. So he may not describe it properly. I don't know. I've never heard anybody say Jerry was masturbating against me in the shower. So that's why I'm just saying that particular description of what was going on, I've never heard that. Is it possible? Sure. But what I'm saying is at the time that the trial was happening, that boy who has identified himself as the person that was in that shower with Jerry at the time denied that anything sexual went on. It doesn't mean that something sexual wasn't going on. It's just that he denied it. And he may have been doing that to protect Jerry. He may have been doing that to protect himself. He may have been doing that because he didn't understand that what was going on was in fact sexual. So there's all those possibilities.
Can we back the fuck up for a second? What Scott just said? Did you just say that he wants another trial?
Oh no, he's been trying to get a new trial for the better part of 2 years now, and there's been. Let me be clear: Pennsylvania post-conviction relief, and we're getting into lawyerese now for just a brief moment, is very generous in giving you ample opportunities to go back and get another bite at the apple to prove your innocence. We have double jeopardy when you're acquitted. We do not have double jeopardy on going back and trying to reprove your innocence over and over and over again, at least certainly in Pennsylvania. And I don't know, I would be surprised if, you know, I think the most recent hearing rejected the request, but yeah, he's trying to get a new trial.
Yeah. Lisa, you should also know that, and we're not going to mention any names, but there are people out there who are, you know, just rabidly saying that Jerry Sandusky never harmed a child, never had sex with a child, never did any of this stuff. And it was all a big conspiracy, that it was all just he was basically set up and framed for this. And there's absolutely no truth to what any of the victims say.
Well, a book came out recently that goes through this idea that this entire thing is built upon this altar of repressed memory. I have not read the book. I've read some passages of it. And, you know, again, there's always going to be people that can, and this will try to pick out a handful of incidents, disprove those and say that disproves the whole. But the reality is, here's a guy who was told you should not be in a shower with kids in 1998 by the police. And 3 years later, for whatever reason, and we know the reason, but you know, he's there again, and he's there at a time when, you know, he's picking his time when it's unlikely someone's going to be there. I mean, Jim, I think I told you that story about when I was in high school. And
yeah, if you wouldn't mind, can you share it with our listeners?
Well, sure. So this is December of 89. I was away at boarding school and they'd come back. Yeah, yes, I got sent to boarding school.
Yeah,
I was that kid. But I'm back with a buddy of mine, and some buddies of mine were horsing around over ice at the ice rink and decided to go over and hang out in the players' lounge completely without permission. Stole the keys out of my dad's, you know, the center console of my dad's car. And we're hanging out in there probably 10:30 at night. And
can you describe that room? Because the players'
players' lounge is a big room with leather couches and a pool table.
How many leather couches? What are you talking about here?
Probably six, eight leather couches. I mean, it's a big room. This is where they would, you know, between practices, they could study in there if they want to shoot a game of pool. Now, this is 1989, so these aren't like the player lounges they have now with jacuzzis and 65, you know, flat screens around the room. This is a pretty basic room, but it's leather couch. It's a pretty good place to hang out when you're 17 and living with your parents. Let's leave it at that.
Okay.
But it was, you know, so it's late at night. It's attached to the adjacent to the locker room, and door opens, light, you know, floods into the room, and it's Jerry and a kid, and he doesn't say a word, turns on his heel and leaves. And my buddy and I, the next day, are convinced we're just going to get the crap kicked out of us by my father, because here we are in a place we should never have been, at a time we never should have been, using his keys. And the Damocles sword never fell. Like, you know, it was never brought up. And at the time, at 17, I'm thinking, damn, I got lucky. Jerry was cool and didn't rat me out. And in reality, he was probably thinking, I don't have to explain what I was doing there.
Right. So let's go a little more in detail, because you swept over so quickly. Jerry opened the door. It was pretty dark in there or whatever. Light comes in from the hallway. You see Jerry standing there with
a kid.
Are you talking about a young boy?
Makes eye contact and leave.
Wait.
Oh, he's with you. He's with somebody.
Right.
Yes, he's with
a boy.
Yes. He's with somebody that I would have thought would have been, at the time I thought was either one of his, one of the foster kids. Because it wasn't one of his adopted kids. I knew them.
Okay.
So you saw him
with a boy though.
Yes. Oh yeah.
Okay. And you guys made eye contact with him. He saw you guys in the room.
Correct.
Okay. And without saying a word, he turned around and left.
Yep.
Okay. So you're thinking, right, he didn't say a word. He just left with the boy. So you're saying that you expect him to rat you out to your father because you shouldn't have been in there with your friends. And that never happened. And in your 17-year-old mind, that was because Jerry was being cool, right? Jerry's a good guy.
He's let me off the hook.
But now, in retrospect, you think that Jerry may have intended to do something with that child in that room because it was a room that should have been empty at the time.
It's, you know, he could have been going there, could have been going to the shower. I mean, I can't speak to what he was planning on doing, Jim, but I certainly think that, you know, in retrospect, it's what are you doing in that building at 10:30 at night with a kid who's probably between 10 and 12 years old and not one of your kids? At the time, it just didn't occur to me. Like, at the time, you're thinking, my thought process is just like, you know, oh, Jerry's running over here to pick up something out of his office, and he brought his kid with him because, you know, whatever, he wants to talk to him. Who knows? And that may have been what happened, Jim.
If that was what happened, then why didn't Jerry say, hey, how you doing? Or why didn't Jerry walk in there with the kid and say, see, this is the players' lounge. This is what I wanted to show you. No, he turned around without saying a word and left. And so
Jim, that's very suspicious behavior. I think the more direct one I would say is, why didn't he come in and say, Scott, what the hell are you doing here? Get out of here. You shouldn't be here.
Right.
Now, well, some people would say, you're the coach's son. He's not going to do that. I can tell you from previous experiences that never stopped an assistant coach from telling myself or one of my brothers or one of my siblings or friends that we were being inappropriate, you know, screwing around, like whether it was in the weight room, whether it was on a bowl trip or whatever. So this was definitely an outlier, but it was also one of those things where at the time, Jim, I think I told you, I was just happy I wasn't getting in trouble.
Right, right. Well, Scott, we really appreciate you being with us and telling us your perspective and your insights and your experience with respect to this story that has really, like, incensed a lot of people on both sides of the issue around this country and maybe even around the world.
I do appreciate you having me on, Jim and Lisa. I really do appreciate the opportunity to hopefully raise some awareness about some of the lessons we should have learned from this whole situation.
So we have more to talk about. So we would love for you to come back and talk to us and finish this story next week. I hope that'll be okay with you.
Sounds good to me.
So before we go, just wanted to shout out to Laura, who is in the UK doing amazing work. And I know that she really would have wanted to be here today, but our schedules just didn't work out. But wishing her all the best, fighting the good fight.
Great. Well, then for now, we're signing off on Real Crime Profile, and we'll be back with Scott Paterno to finish this story.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.